Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 152 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, it's Jeremy Powers, four-time national U.S. cyclocross champion, now a commentator for GCN, and somebody I love checking in. Did you know that Jeremy was on episode 5 of this podcast? Episode 5. That was in 2015, several times from that time. And he's still coming back. Always love talking to him. We have a great conversation. Start out, I get to ask Jeremy all of these questions that I really didn't feel comfortable asking, and I'm sure he wouldn't have felt comfortable answering while his career was still going on. But now with a little bit of time after his retirement, it was really cool to get back and sort of dig into his brain about those last couple seasons and really his entire career. And that's where we start this conversation. And then we move into the theme that you've heard from me on the past several episodes. I now get to ask Jeremy's opinion on really where we're going with U.S. domestic cyclocross this season and what the future looks like. Really fascinating conversation. I think you guys are really going to dig this one, and we're going to get to it just as soon as I talk to you and tell you about CX's boss. Cross's boss. CX is boss. One of our friends out there doing great stuff to give you the gear that you need to have the best cyclocross season you've ever had. It starts with the gear and then the fitness and then everything else, but you got to have the gear. They have a variety of tires in stock, including the national championship winning Vittoria Wet and Mix and FMBs. It's one of the few places in the U.S. to get these tires. They got the Super Mud, which is often the top of the list for the best mud tire made. You already know about FMB tires. If you don't, they're all hand sewn. They're the best materials out there. Once you glue them onto your rims, you are not going to want to ever take them off because they are going to be the most supple and best ride that you have ever had. And here's the deal for our friends at CX is Boss. We got a special deal going on. If you put in the code RADIO, R-A-D-I-O, RADIO, when you're checking out, you're going to get 10% off of all tires plus a set of free bar tape. So there you go. FMB tires, cxisboss.com. They got water bottles too. They got shirts. They got bar tape, one of which you're going to get for free once you put in that radio coupon code, and you're all set. So cxisboss.com. Go check them out. Also, want to tell you about Whoop, the Whoop band. I got mine on right now. I've been digging it. It gets addictive. You get the Whoop app, which talks to the Whoop 3.0 strap, brand new strap. It's kind of like if you have an Apple Watch, one of those things where it sort of lights up at the bottom and it's taking all of your heart rate and all that other stuff from you when you're moving. It's got that, but it's got no face on it. It's just a band. All the information goes to the app. So you can knock it around. You can abuse it. It doesn't matter. It's going to keep on working and give you the information that you need. So this is the wrist-worn heart rate monitor. It pairs with the app, provides analytics and insights on recovery, strain, and sleep. And the best part about this is we all kind of guess when we're going to have good days out there, but this knows when you're recovered and knows when you are not recovered. That's the most important one, where you need to rest. You need to recover. I know all of you train hard. You work hard at what you do. This is going to give you the opportunity to get the most out of your workouts because it's going to tell you when you are at an optimal point to train hard and when you need to take a little time off. If you use the code CXHAIRS at checkout on this, if you're subscribing for 12 months or 18 months, you are going to get 15% off of that subscription price. The band, the 3.0 band, that just comes with it. You don't have to pay extra for that. That comes with the subscription. So you sign up for 12 months or 18 months, you put in the code CXHAIRS, and then you get 15% off. It's a great deal. It actually comes up to a nice little bit of money there that you're saving by supporting the Wide Angle Podium and CX Hairs. So go do that. And hey, finally, I'm going to do this really quick because you guys know, but I still want you to do it because it helps us and it helps you. Life insurance, very important. Life insurance. Not going to go into too much other than tell you to go to healthiq.com/WAP. and then go sign up for some life insurance, take the test, qualify, and get the best rates on life insurance. Okay, we are going to get into it with Jeremy Powers. As I said, you all are going to dig this episode. It's one of the best conversations I've had in a long time, and I was really stoked to talk to Jeremy. I'm not going to belabor that point anymore. I'm going to get into it right now on Cyclocross Radio episode 152 with Jeremy Powers, and we're doing that right now. Jeremy Powers, how's it going?
It's going great. How's it going with you, Bill?
It's going well. It's going well. It's been a while since we've really chatted.
It has been a bit, yeah, but always, as you know, always good to catch up with you.
Yeah, I knew I did it as soon as I said Jeremy Powers. It's like put on the podcast voice since we were like talking for a couple minutes before.
But that's I live that life now too, Bill. And sometimes we have to get in our zone, you know?
Yeah. But despite that, I still feel like this is and you hear it on other podcasts and stuff when they're talking about later. The only time we get to catch up is when we're recording. But I feel like I always am happy to have this excuse to be able to chat with you for a while.
That's not true. I've sought you out and you sought me out at different races, and we've caught up plenty of times. So I wish that it was only when the record button was on, but I think that we actually do make an effort to have a conversation here and there when our paths cross and we have a couple extra minutes in our days.
That is true. And I think that now we're going to get comments on, we want to hear those conversations too. And no, you can't. Sorry, people.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll have to come to the cross races and snoop around with some of the, you know, ultra top secret spy gear and listen in. Yeah. Microphone on the side of the car kind of stuff.
So it's been several months now since you've decided not to race your bike professionally. You are, as you always said, you weren't really retiring because that you were too young in your life to do that. You were just finding something else to move on to. And, you know, tell me a little bit about GCN and what's going on there.
Yeah. You know, I always tried to stay true to myself and be like, hey, if I'm not improving, then I'm going to step out. And I felt like there were a couple years there where, you know, I had my excuses. I had the reasons inside that I felt like I wasn't improving. And yeah, they don't mean anything to anyone but me, but they were real. And I felt like I said this a couple of times, but that it was a sacrifice, you know, for me to be out there training, you know, with the family and with all that stuff that I got going on here. And then the non-improvement and just the thing that I wanted to do, I felt like it was going to be hard to keep that high level. And so I decided to retire. As some of you would know, GCN is the Global Cycling Network. They were doing some live racing last year, and they have a way to be able to, from my house in Massachusetts, bring me into the live stream so that I'm able to also commentate with other personalities across the world. And so I was able to commentate on some of the races, and that led to a conversation about being a full-time presenter. So that's how things got started, and I've been happily employed by the Global Cycling Network since June.
You just looked like you just got back a trip from them, making some video content and other stuff. What do you got? What do you got on tap with them coming up?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot. It's busy. It's a really busy place. You would think that they were small, but they're quite a big company, and so there is a lot of moving parts to it. You know, I have a boss, which is new for me, which is cool. I like talking. I like having a team of people that we do stuff with. I was in France. I guess that was the last big trip. I went out to Madison. I'm doing a piece on like the top 10 places to ride in the United States. So I'm slowly but surely going to compile that video throughout my travels in the next year. And then that video will be pretty fun. As I go to places, I will just kind of pick up snippets like, oh, I'm here and this is definitely on my top 10 list or something like that. So I've been traveling around doing different things. But yeah, it's like I said, it's been busy. I've been doing also a lot of content here in Massachusetts. Just general, you know, my shows go up on Fridays and they're generally off-road or gravel or cyclocross oriented. So a lot of the things that you'll see from me are going to be kind of in my wheelhouse. I know that's a weird pun, but it's true. So it will be more of my style, not necessarily pro road racing, although, you know, I was a pro road racer. I'll probably be, you know, more 80-20 or 75-25, like gravel road type stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was thinking about that though. I mean, you're somebody who I think, especially for that European crowd, has sort of had that secret road career that
yeah,
you know, those of us who followed it domestically knew about. But I'd like to see you on some road broadcasts. I think it'd be fun to hear what you had to bring to that as well.
I'll tell you, yeah, I did. I hopped into one of like the Giro highlights, and I think that the thing that is, and this probably won't come as a surprise to anyone, the thing that I realized, and definitely not to you, Bill, that I'm lacking in is, of course, the pronunciation of a lot of the European riders' names, which I know that so many commentators over the years, yourself included, have really strived to get those names correct and ask the riders personally. And so I only now actually care enough because it's, you know, it's more of like, before I was like, dude, I don't care if you mess up the name. Like, yeah, it's Tees, Tice, Tune, Tear, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter to me. Sana, Santa, you know, what do you want? Like, figure it out. It doesn't matter. But now, seemingly, it's because it's my job. I do care. And so, I find myself being like, all right, I got to go and listen to how it's said and like go to the pronunciation page and do all that stuff. But that's the hardest thing for me is the pronunciation of names. And also with a lot of the cyclocross athletes, I know them pretty well. If I don't know them personally, then I know them from their racing, and it makes it easy. I think with the road stuff, it's, you know, I don't know every rider on Trek Segafredo, men and women's side, because they're not my generation, so many of them. And they're also, I need to study a little bit more, although that's not hard at all. I enjoy the racing and watching it, but yeah, the road stuff's fun. I did get to go to the Tour de France, which was cool.
Nice.
Yeah. I got to go to the tour for 2 days in between making some really fun cyclocross content. So that was super fun. And I was like genuinely pumped to like be at the tour and checking stuff out. I was roomed right next to Wout Van Aert. Like literally my room was only like two doors down from it. It was so weird. Like, hey, Wout, how's it going, man? Like, obviously we're friends and we like hang, right. but it was weird to see him like every couple hours. He's like, hey.
Yeah, but it's also like you all are doing, I mean, despite him still racing bikes, it's like both of you are doing completely different jobs than when you would line up, you know, in the same race together.
Yeah, it was definitely, yeah, we got to catch up a bit, which was cool. And then their tour just kind of, you know, they were insane because they got the yellow jersey right at the start and everything just kind of went from there. So
does it, looking back on it now and what you kind of had a deal with in those later years of your career racing in Europe and looking at these guys and going, what the heck am I supposed to do now, knowing that they are the two of the best, not only cyclocross racers, but just bike racers in the world and possibly of like many generations?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it makes it a little easier, although I definitely look at it with two sides. You know, I think I would have loved to have still been able to be competitive for another year at that World Cup level. But truthfully, with everything that was going on in my life and all of that, and the climb of these two iconic riders that have just kind of flipped the script on everything that we ever knew that was possible in cycling. Truthfully, I don't have any feeling about it other than like, yeah, that, you know, you play the game, right? You play the game the way that you play it, that you can't be mad at how the game gets played. You just have to play it. And so these guys were able to do road, cyclocross, and they have just incredible genetics and, you know, phenomenal team and support and everything like that. And so, yeah, it was, like I said, it was my time. I think that those guys are, it's been so fun, truthfully, for me to watch and to think back, like, yeah, I mean, I legitimately banged bars with those guys, you know, like, yeah, I truly like, even though they were much younger than me, you know, I raced with them. Although Vanderpool, I can't say I was ever hyper competitive against. He kind of came in like a, like a rocket ship. But when Wout was really young and he would come to Vegas and when we would explore the course, I always had a really good relationship with Wout. He always was really cool to me, and we had like a lot of conversations on the road and stuff like that over the years. So, yeah, it's been great to see him have a lot of success. I say that like not even as like a, you know, good thing. Like I'm genuinely like, man, he's a nice guy. He's got a nice, his wife is super nice. He's always been like a real, like outgoing, European rider towards me. So yeah, I'm like genuinely pumped for him.
He's one of the few that seemed very, American curious, like with you and then also with Heidi sort of brought in as well, you know, I know there are different reasons why Vanderpool doesn't want to race in the US and I get it, but you know, with Wout, he seems like he's always game and doing stuff when he's in Iowa and Madison and stuff. He seems like he's got a little curiosity about the whole American scene.
Yeah. I also think Wout is more of like a personality that really likes people, and also really wants to be outgoing and more extroverted and wants people to, you know, live through him in the sport. And I think that for me, that definitely, I appeal to that, right? I love that. I love like being able to see inside of someone and see what they're doing. And Vanderpool is more introverted, you know, he's more of a, at least from what I can tell and the way that I see things, you know, he's less, he's not as much on Instagram. He doesn't have, you know, the same desire to put himself out there as Wout does. So definitely just, you know, two different people, two different personalities.
Yeah. You talked about when, you know, kind of when Vanderpool came in and how this was sort of when he was a kid and you were sort of an older racer at that time. And I want to touch on that a little bit just in for the kind of the last couple seasons that you raced, and now looking back on it, you had the health injuries and some stuff going on, you know, the crashes and the injuries, but despite that, was there a psychological point where you were fooling yourself on the I'm getting older part? Do you know what I'm saying? That yes. You felt that you were still, it wasn't age, but it was like, I can still compete with these guys. I just need to get A, B, and C straight, and then I'll be right back there.
Yeah. I'll say this, like when you're in it, it's so hard to see, you know, the light through the trees, right? Which is why people that surround themselves with good people always have a better outcome, because they can see things that you can't, you know. And for me, that's family, friends, all those people that were able to sort of give you that insight into what's going on with you, even though you can't see it. You know, if you have a friend that calls you up and they're like anxious or they have a lot on their mind, right? Like you can tell immediately, like, hey, you know, John, I'm just picking a name. I don't even know any Johns. John's not doing great. You know, like John, I could tell John's flustered. Right. And I think that John can't totally tell that he's flustered. He's just calling for advice. You know what I mean? And there's that part too with your cycling where you can't necessarily see it because you're so far entrenched in it. And I think for me, you know, saying that I was old was only the beginning of how I felt. You know, I think I would tell my family like, hey, I think you guys should come to Nationals again this year, because I do think this will be one of my last. Like I always knew that there would be an end to my career. And I always thought it would be earlier than, you know, some of the other riders, because of my ambition in my other parts of my life, but also because of the way that I dealt with stress and the way that I pushed myself really hard. I always knew that I was going to have a shorter career than someone like, yeah, I don't know. Not that I even want to put myself in the same sense, but like someone like Sven Nys, right? I don't want to put myself down. I think we were different riders, but like Sven had more talent than I did. He won 50 World Cups. I won zero. So, you know, you start there. So it's like Sven can go till he's 38 or 39 or however long he went. I have to hold him at 35 and call it good, because that's, I did as much as I could. You know, I pushed myself every time to get to that level of even being competitive. I did have to do and train harder and train more and be really militant about everything. And I think that, you know, there is, it's, I think the one thing that I maybe never really believed or understood was that it would stop. I always believed that I would be happy in whatever I was doing and that I'd find my way through. And I have, and I am really, really happy and like super grateful for all this opportunity and these cool things that I've been able to do since I've stopped. But I think that there's always this, can I still do this amount of power? Could I still hop into a race? You know, that's just the athlete inside all of us. And I think for a lot of my friends who are retired, you know, Brad Huff, Phil Guyman, riders that I talk to a lot, Jesse Anthony, Tim Johnson, Ryan, you know, all these riders that I talk to a lot, you know, I think we all go through the same thing where it is, it's important to have a lot of friends around, and it's important to know that eventually everyone has to stop. And yeah, you have to kind of cherish the moment. And when you're in the moment, I think this is the thing that you can give back. That's like the biggest thing. When I talk to a Spencer, a younger rider that's coming up, is like, hey, really, you have to live for it if you want it. If you want to have that accolade, if you want to have those things, then the sacrifice has to happen, because it's because it can be really special to look back on, and you only really do get a finite amount of time, which is something that you know, but it never really hits you in the face until you're done.
Right. Yeah. And for you, I think that's something that, you know, we were able to see, some of us more close up than others, that sacrifice that you did make and what you put yourself through. I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes, and I don't want to throw Tide under the bus, but I think it was him, but possibly not. It was because it was Louisville when you guys were training in Arizona, and there was the story about, he was like, and again, it might not have been Hyde, you can tell me who it was. Yep. He was like, do you want a cookie? And you were like, no, I want to win a world championship.
Yeah. I honestly, when we were training in Tucson, Phil was with me.
Okay. Well, that would make more sense then.
Yes, it would. Yeah. Phil, Guyman came out to train with us at altitude, and we got snowed in. Yeah. And I think, yeah, he said something like that. Right. Yeah. That story happened many times though. So it could have happened with anyone. I mean, I was really strict, you know, I was really strict on myself. And I think, yeah, it was funny. I was reading something with Contador about like the thing he was looking forward to the most. I think he said eating in one of the interviews. Like, he was like looking forward to eating. And I was like, oh man, like he must've lived really strict for a long time. And I think, you know, I think when you just kind of beat on your body, like, you know, Adam Craig, right? Mm-hmm. So one, he, when I retired, he reached out on Instagram. He just was like, hey man, it'll be a couple of years, but you'll feel like a regular human again at some point here soon. Like, you know, cause it's true. Like, you just, I can't tell you how much healthier and how much better and how much more clarity. And like, truthfully, I hate to say this, but enjoyment and like fulfillment I have in my days, not riding my bike 30 hours a week or training, I should say training 30 hours a week.
It's one of the paradoxes that I bring up to people frequently when they look at professional athletes as some sort of beacon of health. And I'm like, no, they're not. They are actually like limiting their lifespan by how much torture they're putting themselves through. It's not, they're optimal, you know, but they're not necessarily healthy as far as like what they're putting their body through.
No, it's not. And yeah, it's because you push it, you know, you push it to the absolute limit. And I think too that you overlook certain things, you know, it's just like, you're like a, you know, you're a huge fire and you can throw anything in that fire and it just kind of combusts, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter if it's, you know, it does, right? Good fuel burns cleaner, bad fuel burns dirty. Like, I mean, there's so many things. And I think that just truthfully for my brain, the ability to not be so type A about so many parts of my life has just been really like, yeah, I feel a lot better.
All right.
I'll just leave it right there.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. One last
oh,
question,
no, please,
about that,
please,
time period. Yeah. Just keying in on that type A personality. Yeah. And again, maybe a tough one to go back and look at, but
no,
something that I think that we always saw you doing, and it was, I think, because of how your brain works and how you always wanted to improve year after year, it seems like in some of these seasons that you really wanted to do well in Europe, you want to do well in World Cups, training wise, it was like a complete reset from year to year. It's like, we're going to try this. That didn't really work the way I wanted it to work. Now we're going to try this. Now next season, we're going to try this. Do you ever look back and think about if that was the right approach? And I know some of it was just out of a bigger plan you may have had, but also maybe some frustration in there on how you were sort of beating your head against the wall and doing everything you could and maybe not getting what you wanted out of it.
Yeah, I mean, a really honest assessment of myself as a rider is that, you know, I had what I believe to be a world-class engine. You know, there were times when I could, you know, Bill, you and I have talked about this, like I could do over 500 watts for 5 minutes.
But wasn't there a time that I think it might have been even the tour time trial or one of them in a grand tour where your numbers were higher than anybody who was in maybe that top 5 or 10?
Well, a coach of mine at that time had said that, yeah, looking at the riders that he coached, that it would have put me in the top, you know, in a prologue, it would have put me in a really good position. Yeah. Yeah. During my peak in like 2012, when I was getting those top 10s in the World Cups, I got other top 10s, but during that year, particularly in 2012, the numbers that I was putting out were, like I said, they were over 500 for 5 minutes at a, you know, about a, like a little over 150 pounds. So it was, yeah, it was just fantastic numbers. And so, like I said, that critical assessment of myself is that technically, I think while I do think that I'm a good technical rider, you know, when I look at someone, when I got the opportunity to literally ride with Sven Nys multiple times, you know, he outrode me. When I got to ride with Van der Haar at like Nock Van Worden or at Vegas or some of these races, you know, the less technical races I would do really well. And in the really technical races, or in a really low cadence strength race, I would do poorly. So there was like a couple of things that were, I would call kryptonite for a long time. It was the mud. I really learned later in my career to enjoy the mud and to become more consistent and have a more consistent pedal stroke with more strength in my legs, because I was doing more gym work and stuff like that. But, you're right. Like I ripped up the script a bunch of times because for me, in the way that my mind works, I always had to reinvent the wheel to some extent because I got bored. You know, if I just did the same thing and I just pivoted just a little bit, which is what a lot of riders do, you know, they just tweak a little thing. And that is what I was doing to some extent. But like where one rider might change 10%, I'd change 25 or 30%. You know what I mean? Like, oh, cool. I used to do core workout. Now I'm doing gym core and running 3 times a week. You know, like I would go in a completely opposite direction to try to make a big change, you know? And I think I honestly still do that in my life where I'm like, cool, now like I want to do this. So now I'm going to go a lot in that direction. And it's not rash. It's well thought out, but I don't regret it, to answer your question. I think that for me, it was all about self exploration, like figuring out who I was, figuring out how I could make any improvements, exposing my weakness, and the pursuit of trying to be the, you know, best cyclocross racer that I could possibly be.
And part of that, I think, which is really interesting, which you touched on, is that you were for several seasons, without a doubt, I mean, with this amazing winning streak in domestic cyclocross, the best cyclocross male racer in the U.S. hands down.
And the
follow-up is then one of these ripping up the scripts, and what you mentioned is like, well, one of my weaknesses is mud. And I remember having this conversation with you about sort of changing from what made you a successful U.S. racer. I mean, let's face it, the U.S. cyclocross, and it's something I want to touch on later in our conversation, but how we race cyclocross in the U.S., how you versus how you race in Europe, it's almost a completely different sport. And what made you successful in the U.S., you know, having that high cadence, being able to come in and out of turns, being explosive, I think one of these things that you changed, like you said, was to sort of not concentrate on that as much, concentrate more on this low cadence that could get you through mud, get you through these tough conditions, and knowing that what you are doing is letting that U.S. crowd kind of catch back up to you.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
But it was still worth it for you, right?
Well, but here's the thing, you know, and this is the thing that I think is really important that, you know, a lot of people probably that follow closely understand, but that if a casual listener would not, and that's that the Europeans come to the United States and they do well because the course is at, like, let's say we're talking about a 0 to 10 scale for cyclocross course difficulty, right? European courses are generally closer to 10. American cyclocross races are usually closer to 5. So when a European comes over here, they're almost like they're on an oval, right? That's right. The type of track that they're on. They're on a five, but they're trained for a 10, and they have been for their entire lives. But when you take someone that's only been trained at a five on an oval, and then you put them on like an F1 course, right, and you bring them over to a 10, you know, that's the thing where you're like, holy shit, like, this is going to be hard for me to make this jump, to get enough exposure, enough experience. And I'm not saying that I didn't have it, but not living in those in those heavy precipitation countries, coming from a different place, and a lot of other things. I think that's where that difficulty comes from. And that, to add to that, one last thing is, like, for me, the seeing that all the way through and realizing my potential there only came during the cyclocross season, where I raced the entire World Cup. And it was a short year for the World Cup. It was six races. But it ended, I think it was the 2014-15 season. Emily, my wife, traveled with me that year. It was our last year of doing Behind the Barriers TV. We were juggling a lot of stuff. But I finished the World Cup 9th overall. And it's been a result that, for me, I think as I look back, is one of the things that I'm literally the most proud of, because throughout the whole year, I stayed pretty consistent. You know, in the muddy races, I think the last race was in Hoogerheide. It was the week before Worlds. You know, it was January, whatever, 23rd or 24th, 25th. And I think I got, I want to say, like, 12th, maybe 13th, in the Hoogerheide World Cup, behind, you know, all of the other national champions. Francis Moray, I think, was like right next to me. And that show of consistency, and that being able to like pull out 13th in a complete filthy, mud laden, disgusting, nasty thing, and to secure that overall in the top 10 for me was just, that literally was one of my like goals for the year. And I was ecstatic that I, you know, no one's ever talked about their result except for me. And that's what's beautiful about it, is because it didn't need to mean anything to anyone else. It meant a lot to me because it was my ability to race in those conditions when they used to be kryptonite at that World Cup level, I think was really what I mean by tearing up that script and really putting everything into those. And I'll just add this last thing. When you come back from being able to do that, and you can still be competitive in the US because you have that experience over there, I think that's when you've actually like really mastered, you know, at this point, like global cyclocross. You're ambidextrous. You can go there, you can come here, you can go there. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. And looking at when you were in that top 10 and just the competition, and just, it really was, I think, at the top of the bell curve for those were some of the hardest years and deepest fields we've seen in a long time. And one of the things we're up against now is that not everybody races every World Cup, and you have like the EKZ, which is a great series that summer going there. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. We're kind of in this interesting place where Belgium may be losing its stranglehold on the sport. I don't know. I mean, I hope they are, personally. I hope it gets a little more global, but that's not just using that as an example, is just how loaded those seasons were with talent. So that's a huge deal. And I think that it's true, you know, and that, not to sort of, you know, put words in your mouth, but I think what you said about coming back and being able to perform, I think that probably was why you were able to do what you did later in your career, when maybe physically everything wasn't going the way. It's sort of building on those experiences. You know, you talk about not even like old man power, but it's just like that experience that you're able to, you know, we all still talk about, you know, you and Hyde battling it out in Reno, one of the greatest men's nationals we've seen in years. And
yeah,
I mean, I think that looking back on it, you weren't the same that you were in 2012 in that race. I mean, it was a different Jeremy Powers, but you're still, definitely, you know, able to, I think, dig into that and build on that for that race.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, that's the one rider that we can definitely say is the, you know, that's the reason, right? That was the reason for everything. I think, you know, Steven changed how I had to race, changed the style that I could race in, matched my explosiveness. Coming back from Europe, needing to be able to really kind of like change, I wouldn't say change the way, but there were certain decisions that I would make about how I'd race, you know, because of how Steven would react to something, an attack or this or that. You know, Steven was clipping at my heels even in the 15, you know, 15-16 season when I was like really national champion. You know, I look at the 16-17 season where I was national champion, but I hit my ribs really hard and I had a pretty rough year. But the year before when I was fully in the driver's seat and I like felt like I was still, you know, the top American rider, the rider that everyone was trying to beat. And I felt that inside. It was like, for me, Steven was still very close, you know? And I think that that was, he was always kind of, I was the goal, you know, I was that was his goal, was to beat me. And so that changed the dynamic for me as well, because I had to think about like, well, if I go to Europe, you know, and Hyde doesn't, and vice versa, right? And I'm sure he was thinking this way too with Stu and the other people. You know, it's like if he's tired from traveling and then I come back and I do nationals and he's national champ, and that's, you know, that's bad for me. So it was just, there was that definitely like a very strong rivalry there. And I think that the way that I had to come back from Europe and race here, you know, Steven's younger than me as well. So obviously the explosivity is there. His tactical stuff is developing. The way that he knows how I race and vice versa is changing. His confidence is improving. If I'm in Europe and he's winning here, you know, he beats me in Louisville, his confidence is up. We have to go back to the national championships. He's never won. He's got a lot of, there's just a lot of stories in there that kind of play out. And I think that, you know, I always give Steven a lot of credit for being, you know, for really having the success that he's had. But definitely during that time, you know, I think he took the title and he has ran with it, which I am like, you know, especially as I look at it, it's like, it's phenomenal. You know, he has set a very high bar for Curtis and for Kerry, for all these other riders that are kind of following Tobin to really step up to and to try to be at. So that's beautiful, because you have to, like I said before, you have to pass the baton and you want someone to run with it. And yeah, Steven has definitely grabbed it and ran.
The thing about you too, that I think that people may appreciate, but maybe a lot of people don't appreciate, is how similar the two of you are. Mm-hmm. And I mean this personality wise, from like an outward, you know, I'm going to go and be fun Jeremy and fun Steven, to I think what's more what both of you are like, which is pretty darn serious and intense. Yeah. Not to say that you're like putting on an act. I know that's part of your personality, but it's just kind of funny because both of you have that in that, you know, and it's great for the sport because people want to be around that and they really, you know, glom onto it. And I think it's awesome. We need those characters, but, and this is not a, this is a compliment for both
of
you, that when it comes down to it, two of the most serious people, I think, when it comes to their job that I've ever met.
Yeah. I'll just speak for myself there and not put words in Steven's mouth. I think for me, it's like, I always saw that as part of the role, and I always wanted to be true to myself. I always wanted to be myself. And so me is, you know, I will say that the only thing that's not realistic about what I put out there is just, I curse more in real life than I do on my show or when I'm around people, you know, like, I think that's the one thing that probably, you know, is just like, yeah, I curse a bit, and I think that that's fine. And I like that, cause I actually think that it proves trust to the person that you're talking to. So sometimes when I'm just like, yeah, that's like, you know, X, Y, Z. And like, even right now, right, I'm like, I'm sheltering it, like I'm being PG about it, because I know that there will be young riders that are listening to this, and I don't want to promote cursing. I just, you know, just when I'm like comfortable with my bros, like, yeah, we might drop an F-bomb or, you know, oh snap, whatever. So I think that that's probably like the one thing that is not realistic, but literally everything else is pretty real with me. And I always wore it on my sleeve, and I always thought that, even this is like before Instagram stories and all this stuff where you can really let someone kind of in some insight into your life. I think that at that time, I thought that probably the thing that people would most appreciate is just, yeah, honesty and maybe some vulnerability. Like, yeah, it's, you know, even in the early Behind the Barriers days, like when Tim was beating me and Ryan and Tim and I all had these huge rivalries and a lot of different riders were winning. I think that those shows were so cool because it showed like real hardship and real hardcore racing and like the come up and everything like that. So when I look at those shows, I don't look at them often, but every once in a while, one will pop up and I'll take a gander at it. And I think that those were the coolest times because it really was a little bit ahead of its time and showing like the inside of what someone's psyche is like and who they actually are without like a lot of, without a lot of makeup on it. How's that?
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think that's why those shows and those episodes were just a huge part of the growth in U.S. cyclocross. I mean, I think that just that did it.
They were fun. Those were fun times, man. I look back at those and I actually like. I think it's so cool. Like even, yeah, even now, I think it's cool. I'm pumped that we had the energy and we figured out a way.
It's a nice legacy for sure.
thanks.
I actually want to use that as a bit of a segue because of that relationship that you had with Ryan and with Tim and, you know, and Jamie and all these other guys who are racing at that time, and sort of take it into a context of where we're at today and even this upcoming season for cyclocross. So in the upcoming season, we have 3 C1 races and we have, you know, a slew of C2s as well, but definitely a huge decrease in the number of top races. And one of the things that I remember us having a conversation with, I don't think on a podcast, just in person, you know, years ago, was the way that you all figured out how to be the best was that you needed to race against each other. And this was in a time before we had this boon of all of these UCI races available, to the point that where we got to this crazy point where we had 3 on a weekend, you know, a couple seasons ago to choose from. And you had this group, maybe it was Tim, I'm not sure who started this, that you all sort of figured out where you all could go to race against each other so that you'd be prepared to go to Europe, you'd be prepared to race at the highest level. I feel like we've lost that since that time. Okay. And now, you know, and everybody struggles. And granted, you had the USGP that came in even after that. And that was something that sort of brought everybody together and gave a national narrative to cyclocross in the US. That doesn't exist anymore. But now even, I'm not sure riders talk to each other even anymore and figure out where they're going to go. Yes, we know most people are going to go to Rochester. Yes, we know, you know, they're all going to be in Iowa for that C1, and then also Madison, they'll be in Cincinnati, and that they'll be in Pan Ams. Other than that, I don't know where the season is. As somebody who covers cyclocross, I don't know what to do. I don't know what the narrative is.
It's a big question, and I'll try to tuck away at it. But I think that the lack of C1s, just to rip that off of, you know, the corner of this, right? This is the non-bread.
I threw a lot at you.
let me rip this corner of that non-bread off. So this is the C1 stuff is coming back to, in my opinion, budget. And it's, I think, really hard for some of the promoters to be able to understand where the UCI's head's at with the, some of the hard things that they're putting on the promoters, the hoops that they're having to jump through. You know, one of the things that I think is really tough is that they're asking for an international field at a Category 1 race on top of prize money for juniors and, you know, matched women's fields, all these things that I'm in agreement with, of course. But they're the way that you would do that, in my opinion, would be that everyone comes down to be able to make it equal. Not everyone stays high to make it better. Right. So the hoop has the amount of people racing, the amount of World Cups, all of these things have gone different directions. There's now, you know, they want to improve to 12 World Cups. I'm trying not to get off track too much here. And the amount of riders has gone down, right? So there's been a decrease in the amount of people that have gone to the races, at big races. You can just look at the numbers, like they've gone down, the amount of participants. But seemingly on the UCI side, they're trying to continue to grow and trying to push big budget programs onto our, you know, most dedicated promoters that are just scraping to get by. And I think that unfortunately that gamble, that bet at the table, hasn't paid off in the way that I think anyone, at least on that side of the pond, expected. Although over here, knowing the hardships that promoters go through and how tight it really was, even at its peak, was writing on the wall as far as I was concerned. I could see that coming for a while. Like, yeah, how is how is Baltimore or another race that's a C1 going to attract five international men and women from five different countries to race their race? How are they going to do that?
Well,
when the race, yeah.
But here's you know, just to sort of stick up for Baltimore a little bit, I think they could have, if they had known that the rule that was in place for years was going to be enacted. So,
yeah, I don't want
to. That's the one thing. You know, I don't know if there should be C1s or not, but I do know that it was a little unfair in how it went down this year. And I think it caught USA Cycling off guard in that they thought that we'd sort of get this, you know, this is your warning year. Make sure next year you meet all the international rider requirements. But it didn't happen. They just lost their C1. I mean, Chris Auer is over in Europe right now. He lives there. He could have recruited. You know, Helen Wyman always came over. We always had, like, you know, more international riders there. But they didn't know that it was going to be this priority, and they didn't meet it. And when the UCI said yes, it is, it was already after that race. But that's just a defense of them, but beside the point. I think you're right on the money part. I mean, even for us here in DC with DCCX, we're a C2. You know, we look at our prize list, it's nowhere near a C1 yet for this new UCI junior men's category, 900 euros.
Uh-huh.
For 2 days. So that's like $2,000. Plus, we're not going to leave the, even though there's not a field, we are not going to not pay a equal women's junior field the same money. It's not fair not to, just because they don't have a UCI designation. And I think a lot of races are going to follow suit. So that's another $2,000. So that's $4,000 that we have to come up with now for our race, which, we're in an okay spot because we do. I mean, you talk about the numbers going down. We still get people to go to our race. We hope we do. You know,
yeah,
right? We have density, so that helps.
And I don't want to set a bad tone.
No.
I don't think that it's down significantly. I just think that there's a trend. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not taking you to task on that. It's a reality, and I think it's just something that happens. I mean, it's people finding gravel. It's people finding other things. I mean, the thing that I always tell you, not you, tell people, and I know they've heard me say this before, is that, you know, you want to know, if you think cyclocross is going to go on forever, go find a mountain biker from the 90s.
That's right. Definitely right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Norba and the USGP have this, like, or like these amazing things that nothing was ever wrong with, which we both know isn't true, but that's, you know, that's what people are sort of nostalgically looking back on. But even more than that, I just want, what I need from you, what I need you to help me with is this, we're not going to have a national series, is this narrative, how do we get these riders to talk again? And make sure that they are going to go to the same events. That's what I want. I want to have this, like, schedule where I know that everybody's going head to head to head.
And I hate to be the person that's going to tell you this. I feel bad, but unfortunately, I just don't think that it's going to be that way.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be, you know, until there's a schedule that is only has one UCI race on a weekend, and the top riders really feel like they're pinched and they all have to go to the same races, then it's going to come down to if there's a race or a group of races in California that geographically Tobin doesn't have to fly 9 or 11 hours to get to the East Coast to do them and live out of a car. So he's going to do those races, and Steven's going to do the races that are on this side of the country because that's where he's from. And Kerry, if there's a race down south and there's a race up north, then Kerry's going to stay down south and Steven's going to stay up north. And, you know, and I'm only using the men. There are tons of women that are in this position as well, right?
For sure. Yeah.
Amanda Panda's going to stay west. Right. You know, Katie Compton's going to stay in Colorado, and Crystal Anthony is going to race Gloucester. You know, these are all, like, the things that I think are unfortunate realities of having such a big country. Well,
you're putting a lot of pressure on somebody who lives in Arkansas now.
Right. Exactly. So all those things are like, I think the realities of where we're from. And I think that even if you did get everyone on the same page, and it would, again, it would be, you know, it's tight out there. And I think that the sponsorships are tight and everyone's looking at, you know, a couple $1,000s, it means something. And so it will be hard to justify the extra plane tickets. Even if the racing is more compelling for the group, it's a complicated, it's very complicated.
So here's, okay. So you bring up the money aspect, and this is my question for you then.
Yeah.
Are people now racing for money over points? In that, especially with the decreased C1, C2 points aren't as many, what do the points get you? You can say, well, what the points used to get me and what we saw in the past is a lot of Americans on the first and second row of World Cups. But that's gone. That's history. That doesn't count anymore. Now it's your World Cup's points that grid you for World Cup races.
Yep. And it has been. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the first year that's happening, which means there's a less of a chance we're going to see as many Americans near the front. So what are you doing? Why do you need UCI points? Is it for nationals gridding? I mean, what is now the incentive to even race these races?
Right. Well, so I think what's happening on a bigger macro level, meaning like a high level view, right, is that the UCI is continuing to push the riders from different countries to really focus on their series, which is the World Cup series, because that's where, you know, ultimately they have a lot of control over that. And we've talked about that at length many times, but I think that just, I have to say that, like, that's,
yeah. You know, I think you're right. It's what happens in mountain bike. World Cup is that's the only thing that exists.
Yeah. I disagree with that. I think I think it's the wrong way to develop the sport. And I think that what we're seeing there's no question in my mind that it has to do with some of that. So when all of the coverage is at the World Cup level and the most, you know, the best riders are all going there, then they're trying to create the most robust, cyclocross series and, you know, basically attention grab that they possibly can. They'll have all the best riders. They'll have the biggest prize purse. They'll have, you know, at some point, Red Bull or somebody will come in and televise this, and then they'll be right where they want to be, and they'll have something in place that then can blossom, right? The same way that they did with mountain bike. That's the vision. They're going to try to replicate. Replicate. I think on the mountain bike side. And then for what does this mean for us? Really what it means is that the riders that are here are going to max out on C2s. So they'll go head to head. There'll be great races that happen here. You know, Pan Ams, Nationals will always be fantastic rides with jerseys attached to them. So you'll see good throwdowns. But you know, your C2s and stuff like that, you know, there won't be less incentive to win. I think it's just going to be, unfortunately, that's going to only hurt us internationally, and you're going to have to play catch up later, you know, because if you don't have a good spot at the World Championships, if you don't have a good spot at the World Cups, and that's what your ultimate goal is, then you're going to come back to, well, should I be racing the World Cups? And the answer deep down is yes. The question is who's good enough to do those? There's only a handful of riders. Those riders are going to be doing the entire World Cup series. Katie Compton, Katie Keough, these riders that can compete at that level, they're going to be competing at that level, and they're going to be over there because that's where the attention is.
So if we're going the way of mountain biking, then I guess my next question for you is, can you see a situation, and this is Jeremy, this is brand new to me. This was an eye-opening summer for me following domestic mountain biking, where we have these destination events that the destinations are willing to put the money into to get people to come into their town and to showcase their town or their region or whatever it is, you know, these visitor bureaus, whoever else, and they're able to offer Epic Rides is what I'm basically what I'm talking about. They have you win $5,000 if you win their race.
Sure.
You know, men and women, and the series is another, like, you know, it's like this $150,000 series. You know, but it's not sanctioned. It is an unsanctioned series. It has nothing to do with USA Cycling. If this keeps going the way, will that be the result? Are we going to have cyclocross now sort of go the way of mountain biking and the biggest racers decide. I mean, and some of them play it both ways. I mean, we see, you know, Kate Courtney, for instance, won a couple epic rides, still racing the World Cups. There are some who can do it, but most of them, they're basically making their living as professional mountain bike riders racing unsanctioned events that can pay for it.
Yeah, I think that there, you know, when you're faced with a really hard decision, let's say there are those really motivated promoters that were, you know, the other four or five that used to have a Category 1 race that are, you know, bummed out with the way that the UCI is taking the sport, and they decide to make a different type of cyclocross happen, and they decide to go unsanctioned, and they still know how to promote a really good event. Because I always say that good events don't ever go away. You know, a really great event never goes away because people have fun. You know, they have it's really fulfilling. They enjoy their time. They spend time with their friends. They feel like they got a lot from what they were able to do with their time. Good events never go away. And so I think that if those promoters start to think that way, they at the end of the day, the UCI can't put on the 200 cyclocross races that are on the calendar. They need promoters, which is why it's such a power struggle at the moment, because they, you know, again, not to poo-poo the UCI, they've been fine, they've been great to me over the years, but they don't ever want to get into a situation like the Tour de France where they don't own the biggest race in the world. And so what they're going to do is they're going to do everything they can to protect that, and that's going to come back to the series that they have, which are the World Cups.
The flip side of that then is, if we, I hate to be this doom and gloom, but I just want this is just kind of reality check here. Yeah. So as a professional racer, as somebody who has ambition to be the best in the world, and seeing how what's happening with the domestic scene and what we are going to struggle with this year, and maybe it'll turn out awesome, maybe we'll just figure it out and it'll be, you know, we'll rock on from here. But if not, if you are, you know, an up and coming racer, and I know this is something that you struggled with wanting to thinking where you should be. Should you be in Europe all the time? Should you be in the U.S.? And I know for you, it was very important, family and everything else, that you didn't want to commit that time. And you also were doing such an amazing job growing U.S. cyclocross. But at this point, is that something that, and I hate putting everything on USA Cycling, I don't think all of this is their responsibility, but some of it is that what we should be doing? Should we be promoting a system much like we have with the road system, where you're going, you know, Europe is where you should be. We'd hate to see it that we're not having these riders race US races, but are we at a point where if we're going to be successful on the world scene and we have motivated riders, that's kind of what we should be promoting?
Yes. Yeah. It is. And it stinks. Cause that's the way that the strings got pulled. You know, I think that there is a lot of great races. There's a lot of great riders. There's still a lot of great people and like super fun events. I can think of so many events that I genuinely enjoy and like races that I plan to go to this year. You know, maybe even pin up a number. Like, I want to go out and do them, races that I hadn't been able to do in the past.
All right, we'll see you in DC.
Exactly. So things like that, though, that I really feel like, there is never, like I said, good events aren't going away. I don't think that the people are going to flip out because they don't get to watch, the top riders go head to head. Although I think it is a huge bonus. I think that American cyclocross continues on the same way that Swiss cyclocross fell out but came back. You know, there was the opportunity there to bring something back, and they did. EKZ's been building for a while here, and now they're finally at a level where, like, yeah, they're gonna have like a highlights package and stuff like that going out. I mean, they've really slowly but surely churned away at creating something that's meaningful in a sport that's extremely hard to get footing on. And so, kudos to them. And I think that we'll do the same here. It's just gonna take, you know, it's gonna take someone that's very motivated. It's gonna take time. But I do think, to answer your question, that the attention is on the World Cup. I think that that's good and bad. I do think that the UCI has a lot of power and that they're going to continue to promote their series, which is where most of the coverage is going to be and where the top riders are going to showcase themselves. And I hate to say it, but I do think that for a rider now, I hate saying this. I really do. But I think that if, you know, if I was giving advice and there's like someone like Spencer Petrov, right, where I give this advice, you know, we need to get you in Europe as much as you possibly can. That's it. You know, because I think that that's where he's going to grow the most. I think that's where he's going to learn the most. I think that's where things have shifted to. I think that's the demo that he's going to need to put himself in, because otherwise he's going to be, in I don't want to say a wasteland, but a place that the coverage isn't as strong, the opportunities aren't as great. And as the sport sort of tightens up, you know, everything, I don't want to create a picture that it's bad, but the sport has definitely tightened up and jobs have gotten tighter and things have gotten small, a little bit smaller here. Then you have to look for greener pastures, and those pastures are going to be in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. And both of us, we wouldn't be having this conversation if we didn't love the sport and especially love what US cyclocross has done. I mean, these are the realities. So what this leads me to is the looming question about one of the ways that maybe it gets better or maybe it just kills everything is cyclocross in the Olympics. And personally, it was something that I never really wanted. It was back when we thought it was this cool little thing, but now I think it's truly something that, at least for the US and some of these other countries that aren't Belgium, that can pay riders and have local sponsors that take care of them, I think it globalizes it more. And here's the example that I will use. Earlier today, USA Cycling announced the world's team for mountain bike. And it's a huge honor for everybody who is on that team, but it is no way the same announcement that happens for cyclocross. And there's no way that it's the same like hand-wringing and controversy and everything else, because the world championships in cyclocross is the top of the mountain. That's the everything. For the mountain bike athletes, the world championships is a stepping stone to make the Olympic team. And that's what really matters. And that's what they care about. So this is great, but it's kind of like not touching the conference championship trophy, because all you want to do is win the Stanley Cup. You know, it's the step before. So it's not the same. Whereas in cyclocross, it's everything. So cyclocross in the Olympics, does that bring more money to the sport? Does that bring more opportunities? Does that lessen the stranglehold on Belgium and make it a more global sport that athletes who may have been track athletes or mountain bike athletes or road athletes now go, oh, well, I have the same opportunities. I can go do that in cyclocross.
I think it's great. I think that is where we, you know, need to push the UCI to really like get political. That's where I get behind something like the World Cup. Cause right, if we can show a lot of value in our collective groups, right, men and women and under 23 and juniors, you know, as a group of people, we can attract a large fan base and we can promote this sport and we can get, you know, all these things. So one side, I kind of hate on it, or I argue my points against what the UCI is doing and the vision that they have for growth. I disagree with some of what they're doing right now. I think it should be, you know, slower. That's kind of my main thing, is that I think that they should be more, grateful for what they have and kind of slowly make these changes that are able to benefit everyone with more heads up and better communication. And on the other side of that coin is like, if they're able to pull that off, if their big gamble of making the sport look and feel bigger and then being able to sell it and package it and bring it to the fans, is able to grow it in the long run. And then we're able to, you know, showcase it to an Olympic committee member or politic it far enough that it's able to be having, you know, it's be able to be in the Olympics, then that changes someone's life. And I think, you know, not just their life, but the same way that a rider that races on the road all the time is a rider that races on the road all the time, even in the Pro Tour, but a rider that does the Tour de France, right? Their life has changed forever. Just racing the Tour de France, that's a totally different accolade. That's a different thing on your resume than having ridden literally any other race in the world ever. So I think that's kind of the thing, is that, yeah, you're absolutely right, that having the Olympics would be would be an insanely, that would provide a jolt that I think that the sport would absolutely be indebted forever to everyone that made that happen, because it would change the whole thing.
Yeah. And it also, even in the US, I mean, we look at, and you know, it was after you had won your national championships and sort of the end of your career, where this national team just in the past year or so was created. But I mean, cyclocross athletes are second class citizens in this national team, because it's all based on the Olympic. I mean, Katie Compton does not get a stipend, even though she is like gold level cyclocross for the national team. It amounts to bronze level, which is no Olympic support. No, she can't get through the front door in, you know, in Colorado Springs to go train or have coaches or have the $5,000 stipend or whatever else that's really reserved for track athletes and mountain bike athletes and anybody else who can win a medal, because medals rule. So
right.
In that instance, I think it would be pretty cool. And I think it would be, you know, it would open, you know, we look at Peter Sagan and we look at Matthew Vanderpoel and go, oh, look at them. You know, they're racing mountain biking, and now Vanderpoel is going to be pushed into racing, where they have these choices to make. And it's really based on where they can win medals for their federation in the Olympics. Just think if we had that opportunity, you know, here, if we could like persuade, you know, like Chris Blevins or even Logan Owen, you know, bring him back into the fold, something like that, knowing that the Olympics were a possibility. I think that you could really, geez, I mean, I would be the first one to be lobbying Kate Courtney to go, come on, cyclocross, let's go get a medal. You know,
yep.
I think it would just open so many more doors if that opportunity was there.
Especially if it was a winter sport.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. I think that is so like, it has to be on snow and ice. Well, just have it, you know, have it. It doesn't have, you know, it's fine. Just have a cycle. I feel like the Olympics, like people are like, oh, but these are the rules. I'm like, well, change them. You have, you know, freestyle skateboarding in there. Yeah. That was, nobody did that in Greece in the, you know, thousands of years ago.
It's just, and it is a winter sport. I mean, there's not like we're making stuff up here. It's not like, oh, well, it was a summer sport that we, you know, it fit into the Winter Olympics, so we threw it in there. No, that's not what happened. Like, it's a winter sport that happens in where you freeze your butt off the entire time you're doing it. So, and you're in terrible conditions sometimes on the snow. So, yeah, I mean, there's no question. And I think that if the summer athletes, you know, that were doing the mountain bike in, you know, 2020, but then they were doing the cyclocross in 2022, everything makes sense. It's just, again, it comes back to the politics of being able to figure out how you lobby and how you promote and how you get it to that level. But definitely by putting it in there, I think that there are sports that seem like they're smaller on the global scale than cyclocross is. But then again, I'm not an Olympian or an Olympic like aficionado. I don't know everything about the games, so to speak, but to touch on USA Cycling stuff for one sec, I do want to say that like I am excited about the direction that things are heading in there, being on the board of USA Cycling and being, you know, knowing that Jesse Anthony is now like their dedicated coach. I guess all I can say is that I'm excited by the prospects and the things that we talk about and the direction that things are going in there, because I do think that there's a accelerated interest, especially heading towards the World Championships that are coming up. I think that there's a lot more emphasis and energy being put into the overall cyclocross program and the staying in touch and the understanding of what's upcoming, what the hurdles that we need to jump across are, and whether that's actually translating into a result or not, I don't think we'll be able to tell until we get to the Worlds. But I'm a fan of that, what's happening there right now.
I am too. And I think Jesse's, you know, still, he got thrown into the deep end, and I think he's figuring it out fast and doing some great stuff. And I think that to add with him, you know, another, it's kind of your fraternity out there doing this, you know, but the other part of that that's making a lot of this happen is what Tim Johnson's doing as well with the Mud Fund. He's good at BSing his way into, making friends with deep pockets and hopefully getting us some more money for cyclocross. So I'm stoked on what he's doing for the sport as well.
TJ, baby, making it happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotta make it happen. Yes. All good stuff for sure.
I want to, we're right over an hour. So I want to I know we could sit here and do this all night long, but we're going to, I'd like to end it on a little more upbeat note, not to say that this has been that an entire downer, but it's been a great conversation. Grand Fondo. Was this the 10th year?
It was. Yeah, it was our 10th year.
That's amazing. Yeah,
the Jam Fund, our nonprofit, has their charity event. It's funny, but it's called the Grand Fondo, which is a play on the Italian word Grand Fondo. So yeah, it was great. We had our 10th year. We had like 400 almost riders come out. It was an absolute smash. It was a party. We did some really cool stuff. We also combined it with a little bit of like a retirement thing for me, where we had like a booth, with a bike from each of my years racing for like maybe 2007 or eight, onward. We had like a cool tent that my man Anthony Clark hooked up. And so we just kind of, people could walk through and check out the different bikes and a bunch of pictures and stuff like that. We gave away, the Jam Fund gave away like 40 different grants to riders from the area to tackle their cyclocross ambitions for the upcoming year. It's the most we've ever given away. So definitely felt great. And, I'm excited to continue with that stuff, even though I'm retired, to be able to continue with the Jam Fund and doing that and doing everything that we're doing there. And yeah, hopefully 11 years of Fundo. I think we will definitely be doing something. I can't say that it will always be the Fundo, but the Fundo for 10 years. It is really crazy to think that that was our 10th time doing it.
Is it one of these things that keeps you in shape and training? I mean, I know you don't want to be like dropped on your own, your own fun ride.
Well, truthfully, man, the GCN stuff is definitely what's keeping me in shape.
Oh, for sure.
I weigh less than I did when I was racing last year. So that's like, just to give you a sense like of how much better of a place I'm in. Yeah. And I also want to stay in shape. Like, I genuinely care about being healthy, and I, you know, even above everything else, like all the, yeah, pushing myself and doing that stuff, it all kind of came back for me to being like, this probably isn't healthy. Like, I don't really feel good, and this isn't going in a good direction for me. And I'm like, you know, I'm out. You know, that factored into not the entire thing, but it factored into a bit of my decision to stop. And I think that feeling better. And I lost my train of thought there, but tying it all back to that, feeling better, staying fit and being healthy, and continuing on and juggling the things that we have going on.
I don't know if like with your GCN stuff, if one of the things you had done was talking to Sven, but if so, is that something that you discussed? Because it seems like that was his thing as well, that he has stuck to, where he may be in better shape now than when he raced, and probably could just jump back in there and do okay. But it seems like he's enjoying it more. But it's definitely seemed like it was a I'm not getting fat type of decree from him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he's also not like a spring chicken. I think he's over 40 now, right? Isn't he 40?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I got to hang with Sven, actually. That was a piece that I did. I got to go to like a day with him. And we hung out at his he has an entire center, the Sven East Cycling Center. We got to hang out there. Have you ever been?
I have never been.
I've only seen it on the race. You have to go, man. You would really enjoy it. It's a really nice place, really fun, really cool. Anyone that goes to Belgium, it's a destination that you should check out. So yeah. So when I was there, I got to hang with him, and I actually did a whole tour of like a bunch of different riders when I was over there for the Tour de France. So it was cool. And that stuff will come out. But yeah, he was fit. We're leading around all these juniors, and Sven and I are like racing each other up the hills at his place. It was fun as hell. I'm not gonna lie, it was like super cool. We were just ripping it up, and I think that we were both planning on doing the Legends race at Trek.
Fantastic.
So I have to find my costume, and I told him to watch it. You know, he better come. He better be peaked.
Sven, Jay Powell, and the cow. It's gonna be a three up sprint this year. All right.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, so it should be cool. I'm like, definitely. These are the other thing about being retired that's so cool, that you get to see a side of it that you never got to see before, which I think for me has been like probably the most fulfilling thing. You know, is stepping out, is being able to actually see it from a different light. It's just totally. I can honestly say that I'm like, yeah, I'm perplexed, surprised, just even being able to like step into Sven's world for a little bit was really cool for me to just see it from a different angle. It humanizes things, I think, a little bit.
That's great to hear. Awesome. Well, dude, it was great chatting with you. Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, look forward. I guess I'll see you in Wisconsin, and look forward to seeing you around there, and also look forward to following everything that you're doing with GCN.
Always. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the time, and thanks to everyone that listened.